This is KUT Weekend for the first weekend of February 2016. Thank you so much for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier. Here's what we got for you this week. An effort to change what was one of the most dangerous streets in Austin.
The entire neighborhood has changed a lot. We're very satisfied. Glad that it's like this.
A new criminal industry growing in Texas oil fields.
He says people sneaking into well sites and literally stealing crude oil is becoming a big problem.
And a restaurant you might want to check out for Mardi Gras.
So you've got this garlic butter that these crawfish are tossed around in. You think regular crawfish are messy. These things are super messy.
Those stories and more in this edition of KUT Weekend. But first, a friendly reminder to subscribe to this podcast if you haven't already, weekend.kut.org. If you go there, you can find links to iTunes, Stitcher, SoundCloud, and RSS feeds. And if you haven't already, please leave us a review in the iTunes store or in the Apple Podcasts app. If you have any questions or comments, shoot us an email at news@kut.org. You can also email me directly, nathan@kut.org. Or you can follow me on Twitter if you so desire. I'm at KUT Nathan. So it appears more likely that voters will decide the future of regulations for ride-hailing companies in Austin, talking about Uber and Lyft. The Austin City Council will decide whether to adopt rules written by Uber and Lyft and put them to a public vote next week. There is a petition by an organization called Ride Sharing Works for Austin calling for those rules. And that petition was certified this week by the city clerk. The rules, most importantly, do not include fingerprint-based background checks for drivers, as some members of council would like to see. So on Thursday night, the city council heard public input on the matter. Some of the comments during that summed up the nature of this long debate. So I'm going to play you some clips right now to get an understanding of where people are falling on this issue. Argument number one, corporations should not write Austin's regulations. Here's David King speaking before the Austin City Council.
Put it on the ballot. Let the voters decide. When corporations write our laws, it doesn't turn out well for regular citizens. HomeAway and Airbnb pretty much wrote our short-term rental regulations that we have today, and look how they turned out. Look how much time you spent on that to try to straighten out that mess. I hope we don't start down that pathway again on these TNC regulations. If the council backs down and accepts the Uber-Lyft ordinance without a public vote, it will set precedent for other corporations and moneyed interests to threaten the council with referendums on other issues. I trust that the voters will vote against the Uber-Lyft bully ordinance and send a strong message that corporations will not be allowed to dictate Austin's laws and policies.
Argument two, council should adopt the petition because that's what more than 65,000 Austinites signed and indicated that they desire. Here's Debbie McDermott.
I signed the 65,000 petitions to make sure that we have a secure future for ride sharing in Austin. I'm asking you to adopt this petition. Not only does this help me financially, but also 10,000 people that work for Lyft and Uber. I myself am a rowing coach for Paralympics. I work for a nonprofit. This is a great way for me to make my income and to make sure that I have the chance to go teach everybody on the water behind us who is adaptive and also gives me the flexibility to have time off and everything like that. It's a really great resource. We've done a lot of great things. We've also just want to let you know that Austin has spoken. These are the rules that we are wanting. We ask you to adopt this petition and so we can move on to the countless other needs and other issues that we need to work on as a city.
Argument three, Councilmember Ann Kitchen should be recalled. Here's Doris Smith.
The city council needs to get it. We're your constituents, we're not your children, and we're not your medieval serfs. And a recall is democracy in action. It's what we do when an official doesn't respond to his or her constituents. I don't represent Uber or Lyft. I represent myself. It's unfortunately not surprising that the Austin City Council felt that an entire city full of people not competent to choose our own rides also aren't capable of thinking for ourselves. Some sinister other figure must be controlling our minds or simply paying us. If thousands of constituents petitioned to recall her, that was other people who came in and did that.
Finally, here's argument four, that ride-hailing apps serve the same purpose of cabs and limos and should be regulated as such. Here's Billy Carter speaking before the Austin City Council. If you want to watch the entire public input session, you can find it on our website, KUT.org. An election which would be held on May 7th if the city council declines to adopt the ordinance next week. That election would cost the city anywhere between $500,000 and $800,000. In the Rundberg area of Austin, there's a cul-de-sac there lined with apartment buildings and a few homes. And at the top of the street, there's a daycare center. Now, according to the Austin Police Department, that cul-de-sac was once one of the most dangerous streets in the city. As KUT's Audrey McGlinchey reports, things have changed.
The beat of APD senior officer Rafael Kianis takes him to some of the hottest crime spots in Rundberg. He starts at the intersection of I-35 and Rundberg Lane, and after checking in with people who work along the street, he heads south to Sam Rayburn Drive.
When we first started, one of the streets, Sam Rayburn, was known as one of the worst streets in Austin. People, when we first started, weren't talking to us, you know, but week after week, we're there. Asking them what are their concerns.
How bad did it get on a street named for a U.S. Speaker of the House? Well, here's an excerpt from a 2014 report written by researchers at the University of Texas.
Used condoms and drug paraphernalia line the street. Large dumpsters are on both sides of the street, and it is not unusual to see junked couches, old rolls of carpet, sheetrock, and mattresses sitting beside them. Graffiti and gang insignia are sprayed on the buildings and fences, and some of the apartments are in significant disrepair. Drugs and prostitution are serious problems on Sam Rayburn and are often the catalyst for the violent crime that occurs here.
The Austin Police Department had designated it a hot spot, a place where historically a large proportion of crime has taken place. In 2012, APD received a federal grant totaling $1 million to lower crime rates in Rundberg. They decided these hot spots would best be served by community policing. In other words, walking.
Hey, how's it going? Good, good, good.
Oh, looks like
you everything good going on here? Everybody all right?
Yeah.
Hey, how's it going, sir?
Making it?
Yeah. No problems. I saw you guys covered up the graffiti over here.
Yeah, we had to.
Yeah. It's good.
Gets covered up again.
Officer Kianis talks to mechanics at an auto shop in hotspot number 1, I-35 in Rundberg. Before the body shop, Kianis ducked into a Texaco station. No problems there, said the clerk. Kianis moved onto a couple at a bus stop. Things were fine. So we hop in the car and head to hotspot 2, Sam Rayburn. It's a striking difference from hotspot 1, which lies along a busy highway. Here on Sam Rayburn, there is, at first glance, much less going on. I find Antonio Mancinez working in his front yard, his white shirt dirtied, his hands rough. I ask him what things were like before the cops started coming around about a year ago.
Just imagine. We were always afraid. It was dangerous, never knowing when there was going to be a shootout.
And now?
The entire neighborhood has changed a lot. We are very satisfied. Glad that it's like this.
Hotspot on Sam Rayburn Drive, in some respects, has been where we've seen some of the greatest success so far.
Professor David Springer with the University of Texas is the lead researcher on APD's efforts in Rundberg. According to his analysis, violent crime on the street has dropped by 44%. Property crime's down 26%.
In part, I think what made that effort successful in Sam Rayburn was getting rid of some problematic renters in three or four of the houses there. And after those folks had moved out was when we really noticed a significant improvement in just in terms of the amount of crime taking place and, you know, more kids being out on the street and that sort of thing.
Officer Kianis tells me that some apartment building owners on Sam Rayburn either evicted or refused to rent again to these, quote, bad actors. And that has helped. But what about the residents who still live here? Mancinez, the 68-year-old man working in his yard, tells us about a young woman who's been coming around, knocking on doors.
I was hired to help the officers, because these guys are not going to be around as much as they are today.
Meet Cecile Fandos. She's a community engagement coordinator with APD. It's her job, she tells me, to get residents talking to one another. But there are challenges. The area's low income, and so a lot of adults are working more than one job and don't have the time. She held a community meeting in December, which she advertised by dropping off flyers on every doorstep. Only 6 residents showed up.
All of the neighborhood has a very high mobility rate. people come to that area and move for another job in to a different area and maybe come back after a while. That's a lot of, some people have been there for decades, but a lot of people move in and out all the time.
Plus, she says, violence in the past made it hard for neighbors to chit-chat.
Well, when gangs used to shoot at each other on both sides of the street, I guess it didn't invite to friendly conversations.
I ask Mancinas, what goes on in the street now?
Now there's not a lot of danger. Now the kids play there.
A 7-year-old and his brother ride their bikes, while down the street, older kids, mostly in middle school, play soccer. They tell me, sure, it's gotten safer. They hear fewer gunshots at night. There was one shooting at the end of January, neighbors tell me. A man was shot and killed around 3 in the morning at the end of the street. But something like that doesn't happen as often anymore. A shooting now is noteworthy. Audra McGlinchey, KUT News.
State Representative Elliot Neistat is retiring. His district includes Central Austin, and there is a race to replace him. No Republicans are running. It's all Democrats. So, as KUT's Ashley Lopez reports, how do voters choose between 7 candidates who mostly agree on everything?
At the Google Fiber offices downtown, candidates are debating, well, sort of, at a town hall forum hosted by the Austin Chamber of Commerce. For the most part, this is what it sounded like.
Well, I think, as with many issues, you know, most of us up here on the stage are going to agree.
I think we all agree that no, Austin is definitely not getting its fair share.
It sounds like we all share the same belief that no, we don't get enough funding for transportation.
That was attorney Matt Shrum, University of Texas law professor Heather Way, and former Austin ISD board president Gina Hinojosa. Hinojosa is also an attorney. So are candidates Aspen Dunaway, Blake Rocap, and Kenton Johnson. The only candidate without a legal background is 23-year-old Huey Ray Fisher. As one can imagine, it's been hard for these individual candidates to stand out in this crowded primary. Also complicating things is the fact that the campaign leading up to the election is pretty short. Elliot Neistat announced just days shy of the December filing deadline that he was retiring.
So it's a struggle, I think, for all the candidates to get their message out about who they are.
That's Blake Rocap. He's lobbied in the legislature for groups like NARAL, a pro-abortion rights organization. He says he's the only candidate who can hit the ground running because he has the most experience in the legislature as both an advocate and as a staff member for a committee. But that's also not exactly unique. Huey Ray Fisher says he worked as an aide at the Capitol while he was in college.
I've always worked for progressive Democrats at the Capitol. I have the most legislative experience in this race.
And Heather Way points out she's been an advocate at the legislature for quite a while, too.
I come into this race with the deepest, longest track record of being an advocate and a policy reformer.
These are the sort of things the candidates are not on the same page about. Other than that, they agree on many issues, including the stance that the state school finance system is unfair to Austin. They all support reproductive rights, and they all say the state should be spending more on health care, transportation, and education. Most of the candidates also agree there should be a strong progressive Democrat in the seat. Gina Hinojosa argues if Austin can't elect a progressive Democrat in Texas, who will?
It is probably the most progressive district in the whole state, so I believe there's a special responsibility to lead on progressive issues.
Aspen Dunaway also joins other candidates in pointing out the political reality whoever wins will face in the legislature. Most agree this will not be an easy job for anyone. Democrats have been in the minority in the legislature for decades. Dunaway says leading on issues there is going to be an uphill battle.
It will be a challenge for anyone, obviously. I mean, the truth is, to get a bill passed, even if you got all the Democrats, you would still need 25 to 30 Republicans to get any bill passed.
The first battle, though, will be winning the primary on March 1st. Kenton Johnson says he thinks in the end this race will probably come down to personality.
You know, I think the key for whoever's going into the voting booth is really to try to pick one of the candidates that they feel a connection to.
Early voting starts February 16th. Ashley Lopez, KUT News.
So we just heard from KUT's Ashley Lopez. She's our newest reporter here at KUT, and she's here with me now. Hey, Ashley.
Hi.
So people who aren't familiar with you, where are you from? Where'd you come from?
Well, I'm from Florida. I'm from Miami, which is a very strange place. But
I've never been there. I've always wanted to go.
I mean, stay for like 3 days and then leave.
Okay.
That's what I tell people.
It seems like a beautiful city.
Yeah. I mean, there's a lot of weird bugs. But once you get past that, I think, you know, there's palm trees and stuff. It's nice enough.
But you didn't move here from Miami.
No, I did a stint in Louisville, Kentucky, the town of Bourbon and Horses.
And you worked where there?
The NPR station there, WFPL.
Now that you're in Austin, what do you think of it? You've been here, what, 2 weeks now?
Or? Yeah, like 2.5 weeks.
So what do you think?
It's too soon to make... I'm just kidding. I really like it. It's a great town. I visited when I was in college, and I remember I really liked it. It's a little different from 5 years ago, but yeah. I think that's a sign of a good city. Like, it's kind of changing and growing.
What are you going to be reporting on?
Politics, healthcare, you know, and then, like, stuff in that realm, like sure. voting rights and stuff like that.
Cool. Well, I look forward to playing your stories on this podcast and on the air.
Thank you.
Construction continues at the Mueller development in East Austin, or Miller development, depending on a lot of the people in the neighborhood prefer the term Mueller. Others say Miller. So for this story, we stuck with Mueller because that's what most of the people said. Just one of those place names in Austin that no one can agree how to pronounce. So anyway, the construction continues there. And on one side, 10 acres lie untouched, set aside for a public school. But what will that school look like, and who's going to attend? KUT's Kate McGee found out those are questions a lot of people are not willing to answer.
It's going to be months before the Austin School Board decides if it wants to build a school at Mueller, and years before any construction could begin. At some point, a bond will have to be approved. But right now, no one really wants to talk about it.
I don't want to say too much right now because I don't want to get myself dragged into prematurely into what is ultimately probably going to be some kind of political fight one way or another.
That's Austin School Board member Ted Gordon. He represents Northeast and East Austin. Why doesn't he want to talk about it? A school at Mueller could be a major opportunity. Austin ISD gets free land to build a new state-of-the-art school. Most of the nearby schools are more than 50 years old.
They're expensive to maintain and to constantly repair, whether it's their AC units or even putting new technology in. They weren't designed for wireless technology. The classrooms tend to be a little smaller as well.
That's Edmund Oropez. He works for the Austin School District. A new school would solve that problem, but Oropez wouldn't give specifics either.
It's really in the beginning stages.
Without specifics, parents and the community are filling the void with questions, rumors, and worries. Kim Mitchell lives in Northeast Austin, just north of the Mueller development. She says the non-existent school is already causing controversy in her neighborhood.
There's a lot of animosity. There's a lot of arguing. There's a lot of back and forth.
Mitchell's kids go to school on Austin's west side because she doesn't like the options in her neighborhood. She wants the district to build a middle school at Mueller.
Because the east side does not have good middle schools. We don't have a good option.
Last year, her neighborhood middle school turned into an all-girls school. Oropez says the district hopes specialized programs will bring students back to East Austin and back to the district overall.
People gravitate towards attractive programming. So if we continually go down the path, which we have for the last couple of years, is really enhancing our programming that we're offering at our different schools, we think it's going to yield additional students.
Kind of like an if you build it, they will come approach. It's unclear what program would go in a school at Mueller, but the district has discussed science and technology or a medical education program. There are larger questions that need to be answered, like what happens to my school when you build a new one next door?
The moment you say rebuild or create something new, people immediately gravitate, are you closing my school?
Closing schools. Neither Oropez nor Gordon wanted to touch the subject.
I want to be real clear. We're not saying we're going to close any schools.
I would never, it would be political suicide for me to come out and say I'm in favor of closing any schools in North or East Austin.
Historically, closing schools has been nothing but bad news for East Austin. In the 1970s, a federal judge ordered the black high school there to close as part of desegregation. It was reopened in Northwest Austin, a white neighborhood. Gordon says the black community was crushed. The relationship with the school district never quite recovered. Even recently, Gordon says East Austin schools have been ignored.
AISD, under its previous superintendent was prepared to, for a bunch of complex reasons, prepared to cede Northeast and East Austin to charter schools.
For 5 years, Gordon says there was no investment or innovation.
So it was much easier for them to say, all right, you want these schools? That's fine. We'll leave these schools the way they are and not try to think innovatively about what could be done in those spaces and to leave it, you know, leave it to charters.
The biggest challenge with building a school at Mueller will be convincing longtime East Austin residents the new school isn't there to just serve those who live in Mueller. Whatever happens, Gordon says, a new school has to be part of something bigger.
A plan for Mueller needs to be developed within the context of a plan for East and Northeast Austin. Without that, I don't think it makes sense to implement anything in Mueller.
Edmund Oropez with AISD agrees. A new school has to serve all East Austin students. But all that does is raise another question. How would the district guarantee diversity? That and all the other questions could be answered as early as this month, when Austin ISD could start holding community engagement meetings. The board could vote on a possible concept for a school at Mueller in May. Kate McGee, KUT News.
Rustlers have been both reviled and mythologized in Texas since there have been cattle on the range. And now the downturn in oil prices may be giving rise to a new kind of criminal.
Rustlers know cattle. These guys know the oil field.
KUT's Mose Bushell traveled to South Texas to check in on reports of an increase in oil rustling.
I was getting a tour of the oil fields from Mike Peters. We were driving through the brush country of LaSalle County when he turned to me from the driver's seat of his pickup and said,
"Let's play cop for just a little while."
Peters was on the San Antonio police force for over 30 years, so he knows how to play cop.
You noticed the truck that was here when we pulled out?
Yeah.
Well, I don't know the truck. It's not one of ours.
So you're wondering what they're up to?
Wondering what they're up to.
After Peters retired, he became head of security for the drilling company Lewis Energy. The guy he was following seemed to be trying to enter oil well sites. That's what caught Peter's attention.
More than likely, he's purely legitimate, but if you don't question when you see something like that, you never catch anybody.
These days, he's trying to catch oil thieves. He says people sneaking into well sites and literally stealing crude oil is becoming a big problem. We'll get to how that works in a minute, but first, why? Why would anyone want to steal oil when prices are so low? For some answers, I took a brief detour to the nearby town of Cotulla. In the town plaza, cars line up for an outdoor food pantry. Volunteers say unemployment here is rampant since the bust came to the oil field. Ismael Tejas put it this way.
Gas goes up, the oil field goes up. And the gas goes down, and then you go back to the house.
Tejas used to work in the oil fields, but he's been unemployed for a couple years. He says these days, a lot of people need to get creative just to make ends meet.
They have to pay for insurance for their cars. They have to pay for this and that, you know. They have to create their own jobs, you know, like cut grass, lawnmowers, weed eating.
Law enforcement says some even take to stealing.
It's all about the money. It's always about the green dollar.
That's LaSalle County Sheriff Miguel Rodriguez. Since the downturn, he's investigated all sorts of theft from oil field sites. Stolen generators, stolen truck batteries, and yes, stolen oil. He agrees the crimes appear to be on the rise and says they're almost always inside jobs.
You know, you got people that they're hard to work, and then for some reason they get terminated, they get fired, and then they know the system, so they know when they can go to the location where they know there's the oil and they sell it on the black market.
That brings us to the how. Just how does this work? This eerie noise you're hearing is the wind hitting the side of an empty tanker truck. I stuck my mic in the tank to get the sound. This truck was used in an alleged oil heist last September. Now it sits in a police impound lot in Cotulla.
It's empty now, but the night that this truck was stopped, it had about 150 barrels of oil in it.
That was worth about $7,000 at that time. If you know how to use a truck like this, you can connect it to an oil storage tank and grab some crude. The next step is laundering it. Lewis Energy's Mike Peters says one way of doing that is partnering with the owner of an oil well that isn't producing.
And all of a sudden it becomes what we call a miracle well. It will all of a sudden start producing 25, 50 barrels a day, where before it didn't produce anything.
Another way is to team up with the operator of a disposal well. Those are places where wastewater from oil wells is pumped deep underground. Disposal well operators can make money skimming leftover oil from that wastewater. They sell it kind of like a junkyard sells scrap metal.
So that's a legitimate part of their business.
But a crooked disposal well operator can slip a little stolen oil into the skim and come out with some freshly laundered crude. Even at $30 a barrel, that makes a tidy sum if you're talking hundreds or thousands of barrels. So how big a problem is oil theft?
The standard answer to that, which comes out of the Energy Security Council, is that it is probably between 1 to 3% of all the oil produced in Texas.
That could be billions of dollars, and that's why oil companies are lobbying for higher penalties against thieves. Probably more controversial, Peters says the industry would like to fund its own sworn law officers, like the ranching industry and railroad companies do now. Remember that truck we were following at the beginning of the story? As he pulls up next to it, it's clear Peters thinks local law enforcement could use the extra help.
So what have you done?
Just writing down the license number. Like I said, it's probably purely legitimate, but I'll check on it and see what it comes back to later.
I called him later to follow up. He said he looked into it and the guy just turned out to be a hunter. But he was glad he checked, just for his own peace of mind. Moz Bouchel, KUT News.
Houston is a city. Some people in Austin love it, some people don't. But one thing you cannot deny about Houston is that it is one of the most ethnically diverse cities in the country, and that means it's actually a great dining destination. And one of those destinations has opened a location right here in Austin. Joining us to talk about that expansion is Austin American Statesman restaurant critic Matthew Odom. Hey, Matthew.
Hey there, Nathan.
The place we're talking about has become a bit of a phenomenon in Houston. What is it?
It's called La Crawfish. Now, as you said, Houston gets some deserved side eye from us in Austin. There is some great food coming out of Houston, and Austin might have mashed up the cowboy and hippie culture in the 70s, but Houston mashed up Vietnamese food and Gulf Coast cuisine to wonderful effect.
So what does that look like?
So crawfish have long been popular here on the Gulf Coast. And of course, there's a huge Vietnamese community in Houston. And about 15 years ago, it's hard to pinpoint exactly when this happened, but it popped up, I think, at Hong Kong Mall in Houston about 15 years ago. Some people debate the provenance, but Houston is definitely ground zero for these Vietnamese crawfish. So what they do is a regular crawfish boil that you'd see in Louisiana, probably with garlic and cayenne and onion powder. But then they add some aromatics to it, like lemongrass and ginger, to kind of give it a different flavor. And then what they do, which is really great, is they take the crawfish and they put them in these plastic bags full of sauce. The most popular one being this fresh garlic and butter sauce. So, of course, Vietnamese cuisine has influence from its French colonizers. So you've got this garlic butter that these crawfish are tossed around in. It's spicy, it's oily, it's all over the bag, gets all over your hand. They actually hand you a plastic sheet when you go to your table and you spread it out and go to work on these bags of crawfish. It kind of looks like a crime scene. You're going to get messy. You think regular crawfish are messy. These things are super messy. You can also get them tossed in a hot and sour spice, and you can get them tossed in more of a traditional Cajun spices. But the garlic butter is really the go-to.
What else besides crawfish are they serving?
Well, in the same kind of style of the boil and then the tossing in the bags, they've got snow crab, which is $13.99 a pound. That crawfish, by the way, will run you $6.99 a pound. And then king crab, which was the best thing I had there. You know, you got to kind of work for that meat, but really plump, downy meat for that king crab is $19.99. So that's what they're doing and tossing in those seasoned bags. But then with the crawfish, they also toss them in these shiny garlic noodles with onion and crab meat scattered throughout. They stuff it inside these cheesy crawfish rolls that are kind of like egg rolls, a great bar food, nice with a cold beer. So they also fry them up and put them on po' boys, as they also do with softshell crab and some other seafood there.
So with the Vietnamese influence, are there other Vietnamese dishes available?
Yeah, they have the very popular and ubiquitous pho, the right. beef noodle soup. The one I had was the La Special, and it has beef meatballs and brisket and beef tendon in it. It comes with bean sprout and lime. The famously restorative soup was good, but it lacked a bit of depth. It wasn't bad, but it wasn't the best thing on the menu. I mean, I think when you go there, you really got to get those crawfish, if not the king crab.
And that sounds like the fun part. It must have kind of a casual vibe to it.
Yeah, it's a casual vibe. It's almost like a sports bar. They're wooden, almost like picnic style tables. You've got TVs up playing ESPN. So if you can somehow tune out Skip Bayless and Stephen A. Smith, you'll enjoy your meal. So it's a great place for a cold beer, crawfish, take in a game. It really gives you the feel of Houston.
Where is this place again?
It is right near the intersection of Anderson Lane and Burnett in that North Cross Mall shopping center. So it faces Burnett. And it's in that big complex where Walmart and all that stuff is. So it's kind of over by the Guitar Center. And then there's a sushi restaurant there called Hanabi.
Well, I'm glad you're bringing this to us less than a week before Mardi Gras, Matthew, because it might be a good place to get some crawfish on Tuesday.
Yeah, you're right.
You can read the full review right now at Austin360.com or in Friday's print edition of the Austin American Statesman. Matthew Odom is their restaurant critic. Thanks for your time, man.
Always a pleasure, Nathan.
KUT Weekend for the first weekend of February 2016. Thank you so much for listening. You can subscribe to this podcast at weekend.kut.org. If you have any questions or comments, email news@kut.org. Our theme music is by RAC. Thanks again for listening. I'm Nathan Bernier with KUT 90.5 and KUT.org. And then,